Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, where we tell stories of people, the planet, and people on the planet. I'm Leslie Chang, and today's episode is a conversation that our producer Mike Osborne had with Paige Chamberlain. Paige is a professor here at Stanford, and I've actually brought Mike into studio to help set it up because this is kind of a more personal interview than we usually have on Gen Anthro. Often we talk about science, and sometimes we get into personal story, but this time I feel like it's really a combo of both. So, Mike, I want you to start just by explaining how you personally know Paige and how you guys met.
Yeah, so... You know, I've never really talked much about it on Generation Anthropocene before, but my backstory is I came to Stanford to study paleoclimate, and Paige was a mentor, and he's a paleoclimatologist, I guess. I don't know if he'd call him.
What is that?
Well, you're right. Fair.
Old weather?
Yes, actually, that's pretty good. So paleoclimatology is just what are the natural cycles in the Earth climate system? Why do we go into and out of ice ages, and on really long timescales, what governs the climate of the Earth? And all of that information is important for understanding what we're doing on top of that with global warming. It's kind of how we tune and calibrate some of the climate models. So
how you get a baseline.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And baseline understanding of the climate system. So Paige studies that, and he has been a mentor to me. Really kind of as soon as I arrived on campus, he was somebody who I developed a friendship with. He's somebody who I looked up to. And he's kind of like an old school field geologist. He's traveled all over the world. He's been in the field a ton. He's got some really cool stories. He's also just a fantastic teacher and a really charismatic guy. I mean, he's a lot of fun to chat with.
Yeah.
And a hell of a storyteller.
Yeah, he's definitely a really good storyteller. I mean, we like run into him on campus occasionally, and he just has this aura like he should be in the outdoors. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, he looks like he was built for it. And he's somebody who I've always kind of felt was a kindred spirit. Like, I totally connect with the man, and he's a blast to be around. He's also a musician. He's had an incredible career in the sciences. And that's actually the other reason I really wanted to have him on the show, is that this is not a man who gets interviewed a lot. He doesn't have a lot of media appearances, and he's just sort of not about that. On the other hand, he has had a profound influence on me. And I would say, more broadly, he's had a profound influence, even if indirect, in shaping Generation Anthropocene as a podcast, as a project.
And his voice is in the intro.
And his voice is in the intro. Yeah, so when we go through the time segments, the 4.6 billion, that's Paige Chamberlain's voice.
All right, should we get to it?
I think that's enough of an intro. Yeah, let's get to it.
All right.
So I'm Paige Chamberlain, and I'm a professor of Earth System Sciences at Stanford University.
And what do you do?
Do I have to answer that seriously?
Yeah.
So in terms of my research is I'm interested in broad questions about what's called Earth system history. And that's basically how the Earth system behaves in the past, hopefully as a predictor of what it might do in the future. I'll give you one fact that I think is absolutely fascinating. And I think it's underestimated how important this fact is. And that is that you've had liquid water on the planet for 4 billion years. That means that the, overall, the state of the Earth has stayed within 100 degrees for 4 billion years. That's essentially impossible. The swings in temperature on most planets are way beyond that. So the fact that you've done that means you've had this really highly tuned system that's evolved and continues to evolve to regulate itself, in a sense. And that regulation is very coupled to how the Earth behaves as a planet in terms of its rocks and how its atmosphere has evolved and how the biology has evolved as well. So what my group is really interested in is asking questions about that system. And it's very complex. So you get to see pieces of it. And hopefully by assembling enough pieces of that, you can start to understand why this is such a unique planet.
Pieces from the past, you mean?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. When you frame it that way, it's sort of like water is like a buffer or a kind of temperature buffer, right? Like it's... I mean, we forget, right, how much of the planet is water in all three forms,
mm-hmm.
And how that, you know, I don't know. We if you just put that much water on any planet, then all of a sudden you're talking about a much smaller sort of temperature envelope in a way.
In part that is true. In part, the ocean plays a big role in the water buffering this, but also it's also telling you something about the history of the planet is that it's for some reason can sit at this 100 degree window. For 4 billion years. That's just that, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that, but it's just that fact to me is just the most fascinating thing.
Yeah.
It came close a couple times to freezing over, but we got out of it.
Yeah, right. Well, there's still a couple of puddles.
Yeah.
This is like snowball Earth stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, it actually, the word Earth system, I mean, you know, it's like I'm interested in the Earth system. What does that mean?
Oh, that's a good that's a new thing, right?
Yeah, people wouldn't right. say I studied the Earth system, you know, 15 years ago.
Absolutely not. In fact, when I was in graduate school, that word didn't exist at all. We were Earth scientists, but system. I think it's a good way to look at it. You're not looking at one component. So, for example, you're not just looking at a rock, or you're not just looking at a plant. You're trying to couple to see what the interactions between things are. Which has really great benefits in some ways, in that you're asking questions and how these things interact. The difficulty thing is it's sort of the imposter syndrome. Like you've been trained in one thing, and you're having to reach across fields. So some people are very reluctant to do that kind of thing. So you're not going down a rabbit hole, and you're not sitting in your silo. You're stepping out of it. And that's not why we were trained as PhD students at all.
So when did you start calling yourself an Earth system scientist?
When it became sexy.
Yeah, sure. When I got a new jacket, I got my nose hairs clipped and all that stuff. Yeah, sure.
No, I think when I started to realize that for me, the interesting questions were on the edges of fields. Hmm. And I had enough experience at that point and was established enough where I could do things that were a little bit out of the ordinary.
How'd you get established? I mean, what was your early career, you know, like what, I don't know, what put you on the map? I know you, if I'm remembering things right, you were in the Coast Guard for a little bit, and so you didn't get to graduate school until a little bit later than some people, right?
Yeah, that is why I'm ancient at this point.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm trying to justify I've always been 4 years behind anyway.
Yeah, I can relate.
So when I went off to graduate school, I had very different interests. There are some similarities, but when you're looking at your early 20s, mid-20s, and you're like, what am I going to be? I just always liked mountains. I mean, that's really the level of sophistication I had. I just liked mountains, so I wanted to study them. So I went to Dartmouth for a master's degree and Harvard for a PhD. And as I was in those programs, I progressed more and more into finding new things. And at that point, they still had mountains around them, so I worked in the Appalachians and that sort of thing. But I was very interested in chemistry, and particularly physical chemistry, and for some reason that clicked for me, so I went in that direction.
Well, I guess I want to try and build up to the moment where sort of, you know, this sort of integrated Earth system, interdisciplinary, whatever. I mean, I know those are kind of buzzwords, but they're real and they're relevant, and that's been the trajectory of your career. So, I mean, you know, originally you are a geologist who wants to be in the mountains.
That's correct. And even now I still work in the mountains because I still like them.
Yeah.
The first things I published on were actually the origin of metamorphic rocks and how heat was transferred from the mantle to the crust and that sort of thing. That was my shtick, and that's where I got tenure based on that.
Hard rock geology.
Right. And the first venture out of that was quite bizarre.
Okay. Well, yeah. What was the first venture out of it?
Bird migration. And So I had built a stable isotope lab. And at that time, so stable isotopes are isotopes that don't decay, and we all have them, carbon and oxygen and that sort of stuff. And I was at a cocktail party with some biologists and was just talking to a biologist named Dick Holmes, who studies warblers. And I said, I was talking to him with a friend of mine, Joel Bloom, who's a professor at Michigan. And we said, you know, what do you do? And they said, well, we follow these birds around and we try to see where they migrate, but they're too small. We can't put trackers on them. We can't do this. So we don't really know where one population goes and all that sort of stuff.
So it sounds like you follow birds around, but not very well.
We can do this with isotopes. So I teamed up with some people at the Smithsonian and went through a collection and built a method to track bird migration, which is now what everybody uses. And so that was a big jump from granites to birds is a big one.
Yeah, that's a big
jump. So then I could back up. But it was a very successful project, and it's used all the time now. So that was my first venture out.
And so just by looking at the isotopes of feathers, you can kind of figure out where birds are flying around?
Sure. So like if a bird is living in Florida and puts a feather on there, molts, puts a feather on there and flies up to Canada, the isotope values of hydrogen are very different than they are in Canada. So you can look at the feather, take the hydrogen out and go, oh, this is a bird from this area of the United States, if you know how the water behaves. And the great thing is that birds don't drink bottled water, or it wouldn't work, right? If they stopped in at 7-Eleven and got a bottle of water, it would mess the whole thing up.
Right.
But birds aren't that good at opening caps.
Yeah, well, that's great. Thank God. So the Smithsonian had some big collection. You could dive into all these old collections of birds and feathers and
Yeah, they had an enormous collection of black-throated blue warblers, which are a really cool little bird. And so we used that as the type example of doing this thing and developed it for that. But it applies across species. So,
all right. Well, if you jump from sort of hard rock geology to birds, I mean, what's next after that?
So after that, then I read some papers by actually one of my old advisors, a guy named Phil England, who's a professor at Oxford, geophysicist. And he—
Still around?
Oh, yeah. Hmm. Yeah. They were trying to figure out how you could get at topography of the Earth. And that turns out to be very important, the size of mountains, for lots of questions, like global climate questions, tectonic questions, all kinds of things like that.
But we should clarify. We're talking about topography in the past, right? We know how big the mountains are now.
You can do a pretty good job with it now.
Yeah.
No, in the past. And so there was no way to do this. And it actually is very similar to the bird research. So knowing something about isotopes, I went, well, you know, as a cloud hits a mountain range and rises orographically over the range, it rains out the heavier isotopes, the heavier water first, the ones with O18s and deuterium-rich stuff first, and then it gradually gets less and less till you cross the mountain. And that's very much correlated with the height of the mountain. So we developed some empirical relationships that said, oh, this should work, and then applied them, and that became stable isotope paleoaltimetry.
So I think a lot of people probably struggle to know what kind of timescales we're talking about when you're talking about mountain building. I mean, so is that tens of thousands? Is that hundreds of millions?
It's tens of millions.
Tens of millions of years. Okay. Yep. And so you develop a technique that allows you to help figure out how tall certain mountain ranges were in the past?
That's exactly right. So that you could then take, let's say 50 million years ago, were the Rockies there or were they not there? Those are questions. Some people thought the Rockies started in the last 10 million years. Some people had a 50. That's a big number.
Yeah. Right? So when did the Rockies start?
About 50 million years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. And that, interestingly enough, the formation of those, it's not just the fascinating question, but it influences global climate. And it's actually one of the Rockies are one of the reasons that, for example, Europe is temperate.
Well, okay. I was going to say let's get back to that, but now I don't want to get back to that. Why did the Rockies' existence matter?
Basically everything's flowing right west to east around the northern hemisphere, and
air. You mean?
Yeah. And so when the big storms hit the Rockies, now this is not my idea. In fact, this is some people who did some modeling down at Columbia. Anyway, they pointed out that as these large storms hit the Rockies, they rise up and they compress against the troposphere, so they become spinning along like a disc, and the disc widens out and flattens out, just like a ballerina, right?
Top of the atmosphere.
Right, top of the atmosphere. And so, you know, they'll slow down. In order to preserve angular momentum in a spinning Earth, they then the storm tracks move south. They pick up moisture around Florida and the Gulf and then swing north to keep the angular momentum conserved and then hit Europe. And that's what actually is bringing a lot of the heat to Europe. So Europe's climate is influenced by things like Rockies an ocean away. And this is true across all the large mountain ranges. So to understand how climate behaves, you have to understand what the lower boundary condition is, essentially, on the Earth's surface.
Yeah. Well, let's keep marching through your career. So you get to some of the paleoaltimetry work. And that, I mean, you still are doing a lot of that. But that actually, I mean, at that point, I feel like you're really starting to bleed into the Earth systems concept, the idea of working with a biological component, a climate component, a hydrosphere, mountains, everything, right?
Right.
So I think I actually just want to spend most of the rest of the time talking about paleoclimate. So, I mean, you'd call yourself a paleoclimatologist, surely.
Sure, if you want to.
I do. Yeah. I do, yeah. How far back in time do you go?
In terms of where I work in? Yeah. I go back working on some problems that are, you know, 70, 80 million years ago, but that's not the main thing. I have a real fascination with what's called the Cenozoic, and that's from 65 million years to now.
Dinosaurs to now.
So it's the age of the mammals. And I had a lot of people say, wow, why do you work on the Cenozoic? It's so boring. Like, to me, the reason it's fascinating is that there are much better rock records in the younger ages than the older ones, so you can get more out of them. And you can ask different kinds of questions. And then the second thing is that I'm particularly fascinated by that period of time is that we know a lot about the climate states during this time. And there were times in the Cenozoic when the CO2 level was 4 or 5 times higher than it is now. So those are states of the Earth that are very similar, let's say geographically in their mountain ranges and all that sort of stuff as today, but much higher CO2 levels. So it's a way to look at climate by looking backwards.
If we were to describe the climate system over the last 80 million years and we were to do it as a straight line and then we were to do it as a more complicated line, what is the sort of general pattern? What's the general story?
That's a good one. Okay, so there's two states. They're essentially a hot state of the Earth when, let's say, something like Denver had a climate like Mexico City today. And then there's a cold state of the Earth, which is now. And that happens, that transition happens at around 35 million years ago. So if you go past older than 35, it's, you think, just warm, temperate Earth with some very large swings to the climate in that warm state. And then we just drop down to this cooler state, and now we're in that. But now we're put our CO2, our current CO2 levels are pushing back to get us to that hothouse. They aren't there yet. They're more like about 5 million years ago. But if we triple them, then we're in the hothouse state.
We're back as Denver, right, as Mexico.
So when I study the stuff in Mesozoic, I'm studying the extreme hot states and what happens. And
that's a trippy world.
Yeah, it's a really weird world. Really weird.
So, like, okay, let's go back there, right? I mean, I think you've actually gone through the exercise of closing your eyes and trying to picture what it was like.
Mm-hmm. It's cool.
Like? Yeah. Was it like? Well, it's not cool. It's hot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What did it look like?
Yeah.
So just to go back to the Eocene. Let's do the dinosaur one later.
Okay. What's the Eocene?
The Eocene is 50 million years, 55.
Okay.
Like
so
that.
Really hot.
And it's hot. And so if you were here, you first of all, you go to the shoreline in California, and it would be lapping up against the Sierras, and then you would climb up essentially through a jungle with these weird, crazy mammals that would be kind of fun to hang out with. And then you walk across a plateau. It's a jungle, right? It's not a desert thing or anything like that. And so it would have been so cool to go back there. And, you know, I kind of like to do it if there was a time machine. Now, the Cretaceous, I'd like to go back again because same sort of thing. It's hot, interesting area. But there you get dinosaurs that are going to eat you. And I'll skip that unless I'm heavily armed, maybe.
which obviously you wouldn't get in a time machine without being prepared. All right. It's Eocene. Are the Sierras there in the Eocene?
Yes.
What are they as big as they are today?
Probably, yes. So this was actually one of the big questions. When I first arrived at Stanford, the Stanford camp was Ceres came up in the last 10 million years. So I teamed up with a very good sedimentologist, Steve Graham, who said, hey, you know, we can figure this out, because if you look, there's old river channels. This is where the gold came from. That and you can see that. So if you drive up I-80 and there you go by Gold Bar or something like that, and there's a rest stop and there's red rocks there. Those are old river channels that were coming off the Sierra. So I said, oh, we can use the isotopes. We can go up these old river channels, collect the clay sediments out of there, they're equilibrated with that Eocene water, and see if they follow a topographic gradient. And sure enough, they did. So they were high in the Eocene. They were probably equally high even back into the Cretaceous. And they formed a platform, though. They were a ramp up to a Tibetan plateau-like platform. And what's made them look like mountains is the back half, the east side, has fallen down.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
You can make a mountain two ways. You can put it up or you can take something down.
Right. Still makes
a mountain.
Yeah. I can't believe that recently we didn't know how old the Sierras were.
No, this was only half a dozen years ago.
I mean, are there questions about other major mountain ranges whose ages we don't know still?
Almost all of them.
Really? I mean, it seems like a technique that you've now pioneered that people ought to be able to apply it with. I mean, is it a matter of finding the right samples or just having the money to do it?
I think it's finding the right samples, and, you know, you got to get enough people out there debating science and that kind of stuff. But, you know, we know now a fair amount about the Andes, Western North America, Tibetan area.
Alps?
No, nothing about the European Alps. Almost nothing, surprisingly enough. Yeah.
Haven't you done some work there?
That's my big plan. I really like sitting in, you know, cafes and... Yeah, I think I might work in Europe.
Well, there's the science there, too.
But oh, of course. Great. Absolutely, of course. Well, and discussing science.
The cappuccino is to die for, though. what parts of the Cenozoic climate are you interested in and why? I mean, you're looking for these analogies of where we may be heading today with rapid rise of greenhouse gases. But, you know, what are the other analogies, or what else is interesting, or what else is trippy?
Oh, yeah. Well, here's a good one. So... some of our research right now, or my graduate students, one in particular, Dan Ibarra, we're interested in what the hydrology, the basically how much water was around in Western U.S. during periods of particularly high CO2, and CO2 that's about what we are today. So we're around 400 ppm CO2. It turns out that 5 million years ago, that we're about the same amount of CO2, this elevated CO2 that we have. So what we're studying is fossil lakes. And here's an interesting thing. If you look at the GCM models, and everybody follows the news and that stuff about extreme drought in Western U.S., and they point to climate change causing that. Well, if you go back at the times we had this amount of CO2, it was wet. It wasn't dry. Southwest was wet. First order observation, there were lakes. That's just a first-order observation. It was a big, wet area. So why, if we're saying that climate models are going to say this is all this drought coming, why was it fundamentally different in the past with the same high CO2 values?
And where is Dan getting the samples?
There are all kinds of fossil lakes through southern Nevada and Arizona, New Mexico. All this area seems to have been very wet, wet enough to basically make lakes. Same kind of boundary conditions, same ocean circulation things, everything's the same. So something's wrong. Either we're missing something key that we – or there's something wrong with the models. But then – and believe it, the two communities are not talking. And we think it has to do basically with more like a permanent El Nino state, so that you're getting a lot of water coming in during essentially El Nino things and raining. But if we're making policy, right, based on model world, then we should also be evaluating paleoclimate world and decide, are we really going the right direction?
Yeah. So, I mean, my understanding at just sort of a first pass of the quality of the climate models is that they're getting better and better at regional temperature patterns, but that precipitation remains something that's very hard to get right, especially in the mid-latitudes.
Completely agree. But paleoclimate model... people like us should be talking to the GCM people going, what's wrong?
And they're not talking to you?
We're not. It's not that we don't like each other. We're in the same department. But it's just, you know, communities have a tendency to not talk enough.
I mean, actually, I really love that you're kind of an advancing a research agenda in this conversation. Because, I mean, one, you're saying the paleoclimate people need to be talking to the global climate modelers who are projecting the future overall more. And I think that actually has been a long recognized problem. And there is some conversation between the two communities.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be a lot better. That's point number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then point number two is really about this, like, are we thinking about plants and the role of the hydrologic cycle to the level we should and can be?
I think it's a question worth examining. It really is. You know, you need to get good plant people in the room, and you need isotope people in the room, and you need modelers in the room. And these are just kind of fun questions.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't matter at all. Maybe the Earth doesn't care what kind of plants on top of it. Hard for me to imagine when they're the valves to our atmosphere.
No, I mean, I think that, like, there's a lot of fear out there about global warming, as there should be, right? And certainly, you know, there's, when we think about the climate, it's mostly temperature and precipitation, right? And there's some other variables that matter. How windy is it? And mm-hmm. what's the humidity of the air? And so on and so forth. But in terms of, like, how do we plan for this hotter world that we seem to be heading for inevitably, we'd like to be able to get rain right. And
you would, in particular, because you want to get information about where you're going to plant crops.
Yeah.
Right.
For just one reason among many. But
think about it. If you're a businessman and you go, look, the models all say that we should be, let's buy up a lot of land in Canada. Well, suppose you get it wrong, right? And suppose actually it's going to get drier than the place where it's actually going to get wetter. I mean, you know, so I don't know if we're right about the Western U.S. or the GCM model ones are right. No one's going to know that answer. But you should, if you were going to be a businessman, you'd want to know the risk.
Yeah. So I don't know. We should maybe talk about the Anthropocene?
Sure.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
Okay. What should we talk about?
I don't know. It's
a thing?
It's a thing.
Well, I mean, you know, the important element of the Anthropocene as a term, regardless of what the geologists decide in terms of new geologic boundaries, is the statement of human impact on the planet, which I think is a really deep and philosophical kind of problem. Because on one hand, we are elevating humans above all other organisms in a way that says we're a geologic force, and for the most part, the rest of life is not, or not in the way that we as a singular species are, and that there's a hubris to that. On the other hand, there's a lot of validity to that statement. I mean, I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons I really wanted to have you into studio was to kind of trip out on deep time and just talk about the long time scales of Earth and evolution and life on the planet. And I guess hear your perspective on this current moment. I mean, are we a hubristic generation to be elevating ourselves to the status of geologic forces?
I actually agree with that statement. But you have to remember, we're very much in a minority in that view, that humans see them somehow really essentially separate from the system. And I don't really understand why that is so. It's something very peculiar about our species. For example, having worked in this area, I prefer to think of myself as part of a system. And, you know, there's a lot of us who think that way. But, you know, even the department I'm in defines itself as human impacts, not really in terms of us, even though we're called our systems, the underlying theme is human impacts. And what are the impacts on our agriculture? What's the impacts on, and, you know, my view would be we might want to step back and say, well, aren't we just part of this whole program? But that's more of a philosophical thing. Almost has undertones of religion stuff for me to this kind of thing. And I think if we had that feeling about it, we might treat our Earth quite differently. I am always struck when I fly occasionally. You're flying at the top of our livable atmosphere, the troposphere, and you look down, you realize, really, that's the livable atmosphere. And then as you fly across all these areas, there are just people everywhere you go. And you can just see all the emissions coming out and you go, holy moly, what are we doing here? We got to slow down. And if you don't place us in such a high priority, you can start to think, well, maybe we should slow down. And so it's a hard thing to reconcile.
Well, I mean, actually, that really links up to me with the study of deep time, in that there is a, I mean, there's an awe factor to it, right? There's a deep humility. It's looking up into the stars, mm-hmm. except looking back in time, right? Where you see both the smallness of the moment and the insanity of it. So I feel like we can't like sort of get enough of that. Wow, it's old kind of, mm-hmm. you know, perspective.
We aren't the first species to change the climate.
No, I know. I know that they did it back in the Precambrian.
Oh, yeah. But we're very different.
Well, in terms of our intention and control and our ability to perceived ability to self-regulate, whether or not we do it.
Right? Yeah.
Paige Chamberlain, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for coming in. I'm glad we finally did it.
Yeah, this was fun. Thank you.
Generation Anthropocene is Miles Traer, Mike Osborne, and me, Leslie Chang. Our intern is Isha Salian. This episode was recorded at KZSU Stanford 90.1. Our website is genanthro.com, and you can find us on Twitter at genanthropocene. Thanks for listening.
All right. Let's do this.
Okay.
Hang on. Sorry.
Okay.
Ooh. Okay, now I'm
get the last dregs of that coffee there. Mm-hmm.